Welcome to the Adventures in Awareness podcast. This is a three-part conversation with Daniel Ingram about his experience of no self. In part one, we looked at the mechanics of how we came to arrive at this perception, his personal journey, and the risks and benefits of transitioning to this kind of thing. And then today in part two, we're going to look at the mechanics of the moment-to-moment phenomenology of this. So for example, does it come along with less thought or a different relationship with the body, self-consciousness? And Daniel also later in the conversation gets into comparisons between different traditions that approach the subject, like Mahamudra, Dzogchen, and Theravada Buddhism. I hope you find this conversation as fascinating as I did. And if you do, be sure to check out parts one and three. Subscribe, hit like, and of course, many thanks to the Psychedelic Society for sponsoring this episode. My understanding is you've trained your perception to a high degree where you now perceive phenomena arising on their own, but causally, some of them kind of causing the next one without any intervention of a hypothesized self that's somehow sitting outside of sensate or experiential reality, in a way controlling or directing or having any influence whatsoever. That just doesn't exist, but it's a construct that's created by how fast these things are referring to each other.
And just like having a better instrument, you know, allows you to perceive things like, it's not obvious for most people that a 60 hertz fluorescent tube is flashing or that an LED might be flashing, but there's some people who can perceive that sometimes. It's, you know, it has this flashiness to it, and why that is, I don't know. And some people say, oh no, you could never perceive anything that fast. I know that's not true. Like sometimes people can perceive things and there's a range of perceptual capability. And so, and they actually, there's some interesting studies with something called a T-scope where they would flash two lights and see if people could tell that it was two lights or one light. These are some studies done, I think back in the 70s, maybe, or early 80s by Brown and Engler, if I've got this right. And like meditators were able to, at a narrower distance between these two flashes of light, perceive they were two individual flashes, and even do weird things like describe, you know, the light arose, it was stable for a time, it went away, then there was a pause, the light arose, it was stable for a time, it went away, and then it was gone. Yeah, and so that the resolution of the brain is trainable. So for example, there are musicians who can hear levels of timing and groove that I just can't hear or play, right? They have time feel like that is just impeccable, and they can hear nuances of tone that I can't hear. People who have perfect pitch, for example, and they can hear, you know, exactly how many cents, you know, a note might be off of its traditional 440 tuning, or even tell you what tuning, like, you've tuned to, if maybe, you know, you did, you know, 442 or something, or whatever it is, you know, as concert A. And so they, you know, they can just hear this, and I can't, right? I don't have that skill.
So you are... ability to perceive the very fast construction of an illusion of self doesn't apply itself automatically. It's because you've trained yourself to watch this very carefully, and now it's always seen, but it's not, this higher resolution of your perception isn't immediately applicable to everything else in reality. You can't, you can't see what these musicians train themselves to see, for example.
Right, exactly. So it didn't apply to all other areas of perceptual skill, but it did apply to this one perceptual weird trick. It just happens to existentially upgrade something in perception and emotions and relationship to death and being and future and past and worry and naturalness and universe and emptiness. All of these are just vastly more obviously straightforward, and all these weird woo teachings that were like so confoundingly annoyingly problematic, as some of my teachers would be like, yeah, it's just this, it's just transient right here. And I'd be like, ah, fuck you. That now, unfortunately, I'm one of these people who says shit like this and is comfortable with it. And it seems just straightforwardly obvious. And yeah, I found that just as annoying as well. So sorry if I'm annoying in that way. I get it. I was there. I mean,
like, not to me, the only advantage I feel like I have is, that I studied tango for many years.
Oh, cool.
And part of the tango training is you learn to lead and follow through very subtle movements that are very difficult even for the person who's transmitting them to explain how they're being done. It almost feels just like an intention being transmitted through the body. And very intricate steps are being conveyed to someone else and to a beginner. You go, can you feel this? Can you feel that? They won't even believe that it's you must have choreographed it in advance. No, I'm improvising it. And this person is feeling how my body is moving and they're responding accordingly. So I had a felt sense of like, oh, there's aspects of reality happening, which I now know are imperceptible until I've trained in them for several years. And then they're very obvious. Like I could not feel them even if I wanted to. I haven't at any level achieved that in meditation, but I'm intrigued by it, as you can tell. There's so many directions I'd love to go, but maybe just dive into the phenomenology of this moment on a couple of questions, if that's okay.
Yeah.
There's lots of stories people hear. There's lots of things that I've heard from different people. And I'm just curious to what extent they're happening or true in your case. So one thing that people talk about, or that is said to correlate with this, seeing through the sense of self, is that there might be a reduction in self-narrative thought or a change in the quality of thoughts. Is that your current experience as well?
Yeah, I get what they're talking about. And so the first thing is, I'm going to get a little neuroscience-y, and this is, so I've got hints that some of what I'm going to say is hopefully somewhat true. And from experiments I did up with a cool guy named Judd Brewer, who likes to research this kind of stuff, or actually that he did on me, that I didn't do them, I was a research subject, with fMRI and EEG, looking at something called the PCC and whether or not it's activated or deactivated. I'll tell a story I think I've told before, but I got to play in an fMRI for about 3.5 hours, I think, something like that, some years ago up at Yale as one of his PCC studies. And the PCC is part of what something is called the default mode network. And the default mode network is the thing that seems to have people generally be in this almost like semi-dissociated state where they're kind of lost in thought and just kind of picking up cues from the rest of their sensate environment kind of as they need to get by. But this is the mode that allows you to like take an entire shower and step out of the shower and not even really remember it, or drive to work and not remember much of the drive. And yet somehow you drove to work just fine, navigated complex traffic or whatever it was. And yet your mind may have been totally lost in, you know, some meeting that went badly the day before, or whatever you're heading into, or whatever it is. Usually ruminative negative thoughts, but also positive thoughts and, you know, appreciations of things that happen. But it's the network that operates apparently in most people most of the time, unless something really calls you back into this moment, like an athletic flow state or some task that really requires a lot of precision or craftsmanship, or, you know, very careful attention to someone else's feelings or emotions or whatever other situations, hopefully driving. But apparently we can drive just fine with our default mode networks highly activated, which may explain why so many people die in traffic accidents, but who knows. And so he was checking this out, and I very rapidly figured out things I could do in my brain that made the PCC go down. So I had about 8-second delayed feedback of whether or not my PCC was activated or deactivated, using blood flow as a proxy for activation or more activity.
Can you just say that again? You had an 8-second
delay. So there was a screen that I could see. I had a mirror that was on my head, and I could look down the bore of the MRI, this big crazy magnet thing that I'm in. And I could see on a screen whether or not my PCC had more or less blood flow, taking that as a proxy for activation, we think.
I see. Okay.
And I very rapidly noticed that there were certain things I could do with my mind that would deactivate the PCC, which generally meant being more in sort of in the body or thoughts. The whole focus generally was to deactivate the PCC. And then later on in the runs, we're like, hey, let's see if we can really activate the PCC. And so, and at this point, I've been practicing for a long time in the fMRI. I'm super kind of pumped up and really on my game and really excited to be there and get to play with this super cool technology and be a part of this neat study. And so really like, yeah. And they said, I said, well, what would, you know, make the PCC really activate? And they said, well, think a bunch of neurotic thoughts. I'm like, okay, that's easy. So I start thinking, you know, I've got a glioblastoma multiforme and they can see it on the MRI and I'm going to be dead in a few months. And this is a terrible kind of brain cancer. And I'm going to be dead in a few months.
You're making this up.
Yeah. And I'm just making this up like in my head and like trying to get myself all scared. And they're going to tell me when I get out of the scans because they want to get their data. And then after I walk out, they're going to be, Dr. Ingram, unfortunately, we have to tell you that you're a walking dead man. And then I was like thinking, you know, more thoughts like, well, maybe they only see this pattern of neural activity, you know, in corporate CEOs and psycho killers and, you know, narcissistic psychopathic pedophiles. And, you know, when I come out, they're going to be like, Dr. Ingram, come with us, please. You know, I'm just sort of making up the worst things I can sort of come up with that somehow seem to relate to paranoia you could get about the situation. And it's totally going blue, meaning it's deactivating, which is not the response they expected at all. And they were like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm thinking really neurotic thoughts. And they're like, well, it's totally going blue and it's deactivating. Mm. And I'm like, oh, I think I know what's going wrong. So I switch and all of a sudden it starts going red. And the switchy thing I did was tune out the room. I tuned out the room because I was thinking the thoughts in the room, like as just little wispy experiences in space. Like, and there's the fMRI bore around me and there's the wires on my head and there's this cage I'm kind of strapped into and this mirror and all this stuff and the body and all the sensations and these little wispy thoughts. And the default mode network was not activating, or at least the PCC wasn't, you know, seemed, it's a complicated network. I don't mean to be underestimate the sort of weird negative feedback things and stuff that happen in it. But, and then I was like, oh, gotta tune out the room, right? Because I've spent so much time training to not tune out the room. Like my default is not to do that now, right? So my default mode network seems to have been modified. It's like, oh yeah, I gotta make the room go away. So I'm like, okay, tune out the room, then think these thoughts and make them really like huge and take up space. Like, you know, most people do a lot of the time. And all of a sudden the PCC is totally activating, right? It's totally going into the red on this graph that I'm looking at. And they're like, oh, okay, that's it. I'm like, all right.
Combination with neurotic thoughts.
Yeah. Just well, actually, it turns out, as I experimented later, it didn't matter if there were neurotic thoughts at all. They could be any thoughts. And so as far as I can tell, it's just, does the room detune? Because like as soon thoughts, as the room like, detunes, huh?
Like even maths thoughts. Go ahead. But even non-self-referential thoughts, like about maths or...
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Right. And so as far as I can tell, it was just like, are you detuning the room? Because as soon as you detune the room, thoughts can become so much more clear, big, bright, and important. Like if I was going to say, what's on my calendar next Saturday? You know, tune out room, calendar thoughts become brighter and bigger, more part of my experience. Look at, you know, imaginal calendar, you know, retune room, say to the person, what's on my calendar? We do this all the time. But we do it with feelings and emotions and thoughts of ourselves and thoughts of others and thoughts of issues and stuff. And when we do that, it turns out the emotional body responds very much as if that's the reality, as we all know, like, oh, you know, they left me, you know, and there, you know, even though that might've happened weeks ago, the body and everything still respond as if that's true. And they are able to do that much more because the emotional parts of ourselves don't seem to be able to tell much of the difference between a thought and the actual experience. A lot of the functional reactivity seems to be the same. And the biochemistry as it goes into our body of, you know, sadness or joy or whatever it is, seems very much the same. And so it turns out if you train and to flip your brain over this other way, then the mind is more inclined to have the default be just thoughts in a wispy room, just happening here. And so if you think your thoughts in the room, here's a fun trick. Okay, so think a thought like what's on your calendar next week. You see how your eyes just went up to the side? Everybody will see that if they watch this. That's what people do when they're kind of like tuning out. And then, okay, now here's the thing you're gonna do. Hold the room as frame, the experience of the room as frame, keep your eyes focused on the screen, don't let that go, and bring, without moving your eyes up to the side or anything, the thought of the calendar into the room.
I can feel my eyes move.
Yeah, the brain wants to do it.
Yeah.
Imagine the calendar like between you and the screen, right here in the space.
Uh-huh, okay. I've got a hazy kind of calendar. I think I'm defocusing my eyes.
It's not as easy, right? Mm-hmm. And it's because we have trained our brains to do this weird thing when we go into the realm of thought, right? And it makes thoughts more clear. I get it. But it turns out you can totally think fine and be in the room for nearly all things. Now, I still find it tricky for if I'm doing like multiplication with multiple, you know, like three digit numbers or something, and having to like construct a whole table of, you know, if I'm trying to do something like that in my head, it's trickier to do it in the room, but I can still do it. Like here's the, you know, the six and the one, and carry the so, and this, you know, the whatever, and this goes down here, and you want to hang. And so it is still possible.
Talk about putting the thoughts out in the room. It sounds very similar.
Yeah.
And I'm super interested in this.
Well, I think this is all just various spiritual teachings and tricks that are just kind of hacking the default, you know, this different response, the default mode network can have, plus minus some other stuff. Like that's not the whole story of how to wake up, I don't think. But I think it explains a lot about the different relationship to thought. And when thoughts are these wispier little small things in the room, they're a very small portion of experience. Thus they have substantially less sort of exaggerated emotional impact. And yet there's also this weird clarity to them, because by bringing them able, that the increased clarity of just noticing thoughts as experiences is something you can train. And it's disorienting at first, but eventually you get good at letting thoughts just experientially sort of speak for themselves without tuning out a whole lot of other experiences. And that makes them much more quiet, much more subtle, much more a teeny fraction of the overall room, because like what percentage of your experience of the room was that wispy calendar?
Not much.
Right. No. Yeah. Right. And that's better.
I'm super fascinated by this.
Still convey the message.
Yeah. I'm super fascinated.
Go ahead.
Because I did some acting training, and I think acting training is interesting in the respect that it's almost the exact opposite of meditative training, where you're consciously trying to increase your imagination, normally in the direction of neurotic thoughts, so that you can cry on command and feel horrified on command or really angry on command. And it's an imagination training where you're attempting, there's many different kinds of acting training, but this is one of them. You're attempting to vividly imagine things strongly enough so that your physiology responds as if it's happening now. But having to balance that, because you can't just be in a trance and do it, you have to balance it whilst seeing the actor opposite you and still being aware somewhat of the room, of the theater or the TV set or whatever it is. So it's this kind of balancing act between activating the default mode network as much as possible, but still being able to come out of it when the director shouts cut and not actually kill the person or kill yourself or do the horrible thing the actor's pretending to do. Does your physiology still respond in either of those cases? If you're thinking all those neurotic thoughts, does your heartbeat elevate a bit? Can you get yourself to feel a little bit tense about some imagined future that's not happening? Or is it now so far gone that you can't really, you know, get yourself to salivate by imagining a lemon as a common one? Can you still do that?
Oh, no, I can still do all of those things. So it didn't seem to impair function, but it made it much more kind of naturally workable, or just so the world of acting, right? So the world of acting, if you walk on the stage and you do this amazing performance and the audience just totally loves it and goes crazy, and you get all the you know, the serotonin and oxytocin crazy chemicals or whatever that go through your body, you know, and then you walk off the stage, and you know, a lot of people will then sort of crash after that, after all this chemical wear off, and then need it again. But if you do it enough, you get kind of used to it, right? The highs may not be as high, but the lows are not as low. And yet there's still the appreciation of it and the functionality, but it becomes, there's more of a maturation of the relationship to that whole process.
Yeah.
In the same way, if you really bomb it and you get booed or the audience responds horribly and you walk off the stage, a younger actor is more likely to be more devastated than an older, more mature actor. Not that it still might not hurt. There's something in that analogy that, works for this. It's not that the reactions don't occur and you don't understand the feedback and be able to operate on that and go, wow, these are the things I did really so well in my performance tonight, and I really should try to do more of that the next time. Or, oh yeah, I really got to not deliver that line like that because it just fell flat and just didn't work at all and totally had the wrong gesture there. And, you know, you can still accept the feedback, but there's more spaciousness around it and it doesn't last as long. The envelope of it is easier and the proportionality is better. It doesn't seem like globally devastating or globally you're the most amazing thing in the universe or whatever. So there's a proportionality to experience and it just, it makes the system more responsive to feedback it needs, but in a better way, as far as I can tell. This is generalizations.
Yeah.
It's not like I've got all this perfectly mature, or perfectly functional, or, you know, perfectly emotionally working all that well, you know, every single moment. But definitely.
So let me just summarize, see if I've understood. Your thoughts still arise. They take up less of your attention. They're more wispy. You're not shutting out the room in order to have thoughts. Right. If we were to measure your brain in those moments, it looks like the default mode is activating less than another person who is shutting out the room, which kind of, I guess, changes some of the science.
That would be my guess again.
Yeah. That has implications for some assumptions made about the default mode network, it sounds like. Yeah. Okay. And, but you're having, as far as you can remember or tell, as many thoughts as you were before. They're just taking up less of your attention in a way, or they take up less of your
focus. Yeah. Yeah. So I think the thought stream runs basically continuously. People who said, I want, you know, 10 seconds and I didn't have a single thought. I just don't believe that's true. Maybe it is definitely true that you can suppress the narrative mind. It is definitely true that consciousness can operate much more on objects immediately as them speaking for themselves or have less self-referential contraction and stuff. But I actually think the thought stream is running just continuously like a fly buzzing in the room. Now it's not always that annoying, sometimes very helpful, but that just, you know, is, you know. And there's also a lot of other categories of thought. So thought also is intentionality, right? There's no way I could be speaking to you without this constant stream of intentions that are, and also monitoring thoughts and progress related thoughts and planning thoughts of like where this, again, the sentence is going to go and will I ever finish my point? And, you know, and so those kinds of thoughts are also thoughts in the category of thought that is creating a past and a future and a narrative sense of, you know, how the arc of the interview is going and other points maybe that we should hopefully bring up and do, are there qualifiers I need to add to that? And what are the appropriate disclaimers and, you know, making sure I'm not overstepping the science and, you know, saying things that I don't, you know, think are true and wondering if people will misunderstand and like thinking about the terms I may have used that maybe, you know, weren't as clear and could be ontologically or existentially confusing and those words again. And so, like that whole process is just a normal part of interaction, right? That's just how the machine functions. So I don't think there's any less of that. But the proportionality on it is really different. And the experience of it as experience is really different.
And earlier you mentioned how the sense of intention is very wrapped up a lot of the time with the sense of self. Are you saying you still have a sense of intention and a sense of self, but you're seeing through it as illusion as it arises, or something of that has dropped away, a sense of agency or intention, or is that functioning the same as before?
All of the intentions are still totally functioning. They're just not being mistaken as a true, stable, acausal self that stands outside of this causal universe, mm-hmm. nor are the mental impressions that seem to at one point actually be the knowledge rather than just being these coarse, super crude little wispy things that are nothing like, you know, if I try to remember the screen and I close my eyes and I bring up the screen in memory, it's nothing like the full experience of this screen. It's this vague, weird, flickery, sort of glitchy shorthand that if you turned it in as an art project, it would be the most ridiculous abstract art that people would have a super hard time extrapolating screen from. And yet somehow, you know, it's screen, you know, if you could just like take a picture of that and go, you know, if you were in a realistic art class, everybody would go, you know, but yet it somehow has this functionality to it, which is still fine. So that functionality is still there. I can still think the thought I just as easily as I could before, you know, I am here talking to you on a podcast, you know, those thoughts are just still there, but they're just like everything else. They have that same quality of just experience unfolding, just like the whole rest of it does. Not more, not less, just straightforward.
And there's no sense of being outside of any of this, as it were, an observer of this outside of it.
That there's still the sort of the physiology of reference pointiness. So all of the sensations that make that up, like, you know, eyes are over here, eyes turned this way. There's still all these little sensations of eyeball, of eye, of eyelash, of movement, of intentionality, of perspective. This is here, that is there. These eyes appear to be looking at that webcam. You know, there's these sort of relational things, and there's like sensations here of eyes that might be like imagining a hand is over here or something. You know, all the sort of the sensations that make up relation and perspective are still there, but none of that is taken to be an actual true objective perceiver. Meaning these are all just, it's hard to explain, except that it's very straightforward from this point of view, but it was maddeningly vexing, even though I understood the theory of it for years. The actual deconstruction of it was a project that I had to learn. Just like someone could say, well, here's how you play the scale on the guitar, but I still had to play it a whole lot of times to get good at it.
So as I sit here listening to you, I occasionally have a feeling of I, or, and I'm saying this kind of not to make this a class, but just a contrast. But okay, so do you, yeah, so that's my question. So as I feel I, or as I think I was like, oh, Daniel's talking to me, I might feel a momentary heat or sensation around my chest or something like this. Which if I look at it, it's like, well, that's just something that's coming and going. That's clearly not me, but I have to pause and look at it for that to happen. Outside of that, I still just have that sense. So you're saying you will still have those body sensations arise on saying the word I, as an example, or?
Yeah.
Okay. It just takes you less, like I have to pause and look at it and think, is that really me? Is it always there? And then it's seen through not to be me. And correct me if I'm wrong, you just don't have to pause to see that that's not a you.
It's baked in. It arises interpreted that way. Just like in a magic eye painting, when you cross your eyes just right and the three-dimensional thing emerges, you're not having to think, is there a three-dimensional thing there? That is just what you're perceiving. I mean, you can think that as one of the oscillating thoughts back and forth with the sensations that are the scanning around that little three-dimensional thing that give it the sense of solidity and continuity as you check out various aspects of it and blah, 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 fast oscillation. But you're not having to do anything. It's now a perceptual change that has somehow occurred. This is a perceptual change that has somehow occurred. It's occurring at the level of pre-processing in the same way that if you hypothesize an actual world that then gets filtered, you know, to the pre-processed data that we have, this is now happening at the level of pre-processing.
Mm-hmm.
And
you couldn't switch it off even if you wanted to.
System.
Yeah. No.
And it's funny, like I tried because I was skeptical as heck because I'd kind of been fooled a bunch of times. And so I actually spent hours and hours and hours trying to figure out, okay, is this going to, you know, break apart and become glitchy and dualistic like it had so many times before? And, you know, 17 years later, I've totally failed from an ordinary
point
trying, of
view. Keep trying, I can train you. Did your wife or close friends, like if you hadn't have said anything, would anyone have noticed, do you think, a difference?
I don't think so.
All right.
Which is disappointing to everyone, I'm sure. But I don't think much.
It kind of matches with a metaphor that I've heard used, which makes sense to me, of a wave believing it's a wave, at some point recognizing it's water. It has always been water, will never not be water, and there's no need to fear it, the wave crashing into the sea, and nothing about the wave has to change for it to perceive that it's water. It was always water, so it kind of makes sense to me at one level.
Yeah,
I do remember being disappointed with that when I first heard that. It doesn't mean you can walk on water. So you've identified somehow, you like there's an equality to all sense perceptions, but at the same time you can distinguish, I don't know if you're in gallery view on Zoom, but you can distinguish obviously between the face that we call Daniel's face and the face we call Amir's face, And there might be certain body sensation associations with one face more than the other. Has there been a diminishment in self-consciousness? Like you meant, you mentioned wondering if the angle is right or this or that. Is that just pure pragmatism, or can self-consciousness still, it's so paradoxical, I love it. There's no sense of self, I can still get self-conscious. Can that still arrive?
Yes, there is still all of the processes of self-consciousness in that ordinary psychological comparative sense are still utterly operating. None of them stopped. Is the perspective on them very different in that same sort of proportional, you know, all these sensations, and by the way, there's little sensations of self-consciousness here and comparative thoughts and, you know, oh, is the lighting good? You know, oh, your lighting is so much warmer than mine. Maybe I should have put an additional, you know, amber filter on one of my LED lights or something. You know, like, how is this going to look in post? And you know, all those kinds of things. Am I moving my hands too much? You know, do I make these goofy facial expressions? You know, yeah, I do. And, you know, and how will that look later when I look at it on the camera? You know, and so all of those thoughts are still totally occurring in that very ordinary way. But that's the kind of feedback you need to, like, be able to do stuff, right? That's just how the system helps to hopefully make the video a little bit better, or hopefully make you a little bit better, you know, the next time one does a presentation, or, you know, does a podcast, that hopefully it will, you know, go better for the audience or be easier to watch or whatever it is. And all of those thoughts are still totally there, but there is this proportionality to them. So they're just kind of like these little things, wispy-ish things in here, but it's not like they're not happening. Of course they are. That's how I'm able to do all this. And people who say, oh, I have no self-referential thoughts. Well, like, in that instant, I have no self-referential thoughts. Like, right, dude. No, of course you do. I mean, from an ordinary point of view. And so from an ordinary point of view, all those things are still happening.
I mean, I found it fascinating looking at some of the studies recently on people who, without any relationship to meditation or enlightenment or any of this stuff, say, report that they have no internal monologue, no internal narrative, or there's a parallel, and sometimes they come together, I think, aphantasia, where there's no internal imagery. And so their felt sense of having thoughts, the way I think of thoughts, of being either verbal or images, that does seem to be able to be a thing, and just a kind of an immediate functioning and response. But you're saying that's not related, or do you not believe that's really happening in that case, and they're kind of just unaware of the thoughts that are there? Or
I've had a chance to actually talk for, I think it was almost like 2 hours or something, with at a conference with one of the people who claims this, in a book with a title that would seem to hint that straight out of the gate. I'm not gonna, like, and after super careful phenomenological questioning in a way that I got the sense they weren't generally subjected to, like, there are still planning thoughts, there are still intentional thoughts, there are still monitoring thoughts. You know, they know what the email is gonna say kind of before they write it. They still externally totally seem to have moods, even if they somehow seem to have convinced themselves, they've trained themselves to not be able to perceive them. And yet, if you, like, annoy them in real time and you ask, do you think you're annoyed right now or not annoyed? They can take a guess, it turns out, of, you know, they, and they're able to say, like, thoughts like, well, I don't have any internal monologue. Well, there were all kinds of thoughts that had to be going on internal monologue and monitoring to even say something like that. There's a planning function, even if they somehow convince themselves through, is that subtle association? Is that scripting? Is that just a profound deactivation of PCC stuff? Is that saying, well, yeah, these super wispy little thoughts are no thoughts? I mean, like, exactly what's the fine gradation of this? And how do people's presentations get modified by the spiritual ideals they've been coming from, and what their models of perfection are, and all of that stuff, right? It turns out, when you really start kicking those tires pretty hard, that some of those that idealism can kind of break down. And there are all kinds of funny stories about, like, you know, the woman who said she had, you know, no thoughts at all, and the Tibetan teacher saying, you know, like, well, just let's wait and let's just see when you think a thought. Just go ahead and tell us when you think a thought, and we'll all just wait here until you actually have a thought arise, at which point they start getting nervous and going, oh, wait, I'm having all these thoughts about whether or not I'm not having thoughts. Oh, yeah, oops. So, like, I'm pretty skeptical. Is it possible there are weird, curious variants out there? I mean, I've seen so many strange things in medicine and meditation. Maybe there really are people who somehow totally disconnect from any experience of any of that. but do I think it's still functionally functioning somewhere in order for them to like exist in the world? Yeah. Like, and then the functional difference is what? I don't know. Like, do these people still clearly have moods and emotions, and you can slight them if you insult their sense of I, and, you know, so a rose by any other name would maybe still smell like a rose. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
So maybe it's a thing you're skeptical, but it certainly isn't necessary for the kind of perception that you're talking about to arise. This kind right. of wonder perception. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe this invalidates another question I had, but it'll be interesting to get your perspective on anyway, because this kind of thing of no thought, of eliminating thought, of the I thought, I notice it come up more in maybe Hindu traditions, Advaita, this kind of thing. And it often seems to be wrapped up in an idea that I hear much more often in Hindu Advaita non-dual teachings, this idea of I am not the body, or the root cause of suffering is identification with the body. Is that whole kind of thing not really wrapped up in your approach then? This idea of not needing to identify and I am not the body, and is it just irrelevant from your perspective? It's about
okay, that gets resolution. Super complicated. And from a certain point of view, I've totally de-identified with body and everything. Right? From a sort of perceptual point of view, like there's that whole weird dance of I am these sensations and I'm not those sensations at the deepest sort of existential perceptual level is gone. And yet there's still clearly the ability to discriminate. Here's my finger and here's not my finger and here's empty space and here's webcam being touched by finger. Webcam is not me. This is me from any ordinary sort of medical protect myself point of view. And what's interesting is, you know, a lot of the people who said, well, I can't think a thought of myself. Well, they just did. And they were able to write books, which involves planning and thinking. And they were able to give teachings, which involves structure and clear organization. And they were able to discuss nuanced concepts, you know, about self and other and the self with the big S and self with a little S. And they're all able to do all that stuff. And they're able to care for themselves and wash themselves. And so functionally, like, because the problem is there are all these kind of different levels of what does identification mean, right? And so you've got to kind of tease out that word. And I can, from an ordinary point of view, say these are my fingers, right? But from a perceptual point of view, these sensations are just occurring here and knowing themselves where they are. But all the discrimination is also doing that same thing. And so is that identification? Is that de-identification? It really depends on the sort of functional and perceptual versus intellectual versus psychological level that you're talking about, because identification has all these aspects to it. And the problem is when you say one and you don't give any qualifiers on what it means to identify or de-identify, then people tend to just sort of glom on all these different kind of possible layers of meanings of interpretation in a mishmash, because most people, when they use a term like that or a word like that, aren't really picking it apart to sort of talk about what are the layers of identification and function and how each of those are kind of different.
Yeah. I've often been very confused by this word identification, and it's like another mystery for me. Well, I'm not even sure what I mean when I say I identify with this or a sense of identification arises. What's clear to me is that I don't feel identified with the tree outside or the table, but somehow I feel more identified with that one of those faces and not the other.
Sure.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just dig into this sense of identification or perception of what is me and what isn't me. I'm sure you know the rubber hand illusion, right? Where mm-hmm. it doesn't take very, and I'll just say it quickly in case anyone hasn't heard of it, and correct me if I get it completely wrong, but you can put a fake rubber hand next to someone while covering their real hand. And if you stroke their real finger at the same time as the rubber hand finger, not very much time, their perception changes, where it starts to feel like the rubber hand belongs to their body, and their real hand, as long as it's not in their view, doesn't belong to them anymore. It's really quite easy to get someone to disidentify with part of their body. And what's even more interesting about that to me is that it seems to arise with a suppressed immune response in their real hand. So there's, let me just check because I wrote it down somewhere. There's a reduced blood flow, reduced temperature. It seems there's a lower immune response, an increased histamine reactivity. And then someone else I read how even bacteria possess a recognition system to defend themselves from what isn't them. So there's a kind of biological apparatus that is distinguishing between me, this belongs inside this enclosed system at some level, and what isn't me and has to be defended against. Clearly that's still functioning okay in your case and has to be functioning in many cases. Do you think that there's a danger at some level or a possibility with some of these teachings where someone kind of goes in the wrong direction and kind of rubber hands their whole body, like kind of disidentify so completely with the whole body that they start to get sick because of it, or in a way that isn't really required, it sounds like, to have the perception that you're having?
So I've never done the rubber hand experiment, but I have traveled out of body or had the experience that I was traveling out of body. Now, and the experience, regardless of any ontological implications, is that there is the body and there is you. And now you're feeling and seeming to control and inhabit a space that feels as real as this and sometimes more real, and yet behaves in extremely bizarre ways. And your body can actually look like different things sometimes. It usually tracks pretty closely and to what you're used to, but not always, for those who have had some of the weirder end of out-of-body experiences. Or if anybody's done like Tibetan tantric, you know, where you arise as a deity, practices strongly enough, you can actually like literally be seeing yourself, you know, if you take this to kind of the far extreme level of what can happen, as something else, right? That is your literal perception, regardless of anything to do with accuracy. And so my experience of out-of-body travel has often left me sort of weirdly kind of like disoriented, kind of ungrounded, feeling spacey or like not really here or something, sometimes for hours to days afterwards, right? So it's not actually one of these things I like doing that much. And when it happens, there's always sort of this like weird disorientation, subtle, sometimes stronger price to pay depending on how long I was out and what happened. So really long travels, which for me are like 5 to 7 minutes, which is super long from my point of view. Most of mine have been in the realm of seconds, but even the ones that are in the realms of seconds are weirdly disorienting in some kind of way that I can totally get why you get the myths out there, or not necessarily mythological stuff, maybe, of like, if you spend too much time outside of your body, then it's just not gonna go well. It's not gonna, you know, you're somehow gonna lose life essence or whatever. I can sort of understand something of where you hear things like that, or your consciousness might, you know, not be able to. I actually think you're always going to snap back, but like that there is something about that non-association with your body that is kind of pretty weird for it and for the system. Like, do I think astral travels is safe? And have I heard anybody dying or had bad stuff happening? No, but I definitely get that weird sense that you're changing something physiologically kind of about it when you come back, even if you're out for a relatively small amount of time. And I've definitely felt that. It's still something I would do again sometimes. And if it happens to me, I wouldn't worry about it. So I'm not kind of trying to cause stress about this. But I, to give these kinds of things their due, I sort of get the weird thing that happens when you associate with something else as your body that is not your sort of ordinary body as we would conventionally think of it.
And do you think it's a misunderstanding, a mistranslation, or from what I've read, someone like Ramana Maharshi would insist, if there's even a remnant of a sense of individualization or a sense of I, then more work has to be done, this kind of approach. Do you see that as a different approach or a different wording of the same approach?
Yeah, so I can definitely tell you that from a sort of a bare perceptual duality point of view, the difference between like what seemed like 99% of my experience being perceived that way, but 1% holding out, and the whole thing just flipping over unabashedly without any obvious glitches in it, is huge. So yes, it was a quantum leap of profound proportions. And even as cool as all the sort of shifts along the way that led to that were, then there's this. And since April 2003, this is just categorically different and better. And so from that kind of point of view, I would totally agree. Now, the degree to which you can then you know, eliminate all thoughts of I or all that kind of stuff, that's where I start to go, okay, there's a problem here. Because even Ramana could say the word I and talk about it and say, when I was a boy, I this, when I did this, I meditated like this, and, you know, could have a linear narrative story and history, and all that functionality was still preserved. You know, maybe he was perceiving it in a way that is extremely perceptually different and maybe complete. Again, it's hard to evaluate people's practices. You know, I don't mean to disparage his practice or say I'm certain it was a great way. I don't know. Just to maintain some sort of reasonable skepticism, because we don't have the tools yet to objectively measure anybody and say, have you totally flipped it over? And there's no sense of subtle duality or identification and perception or something. Assuming he had done it, you know, giving him the benefit of the doubt that maybe his descriptions had some validity or use, then still he could say I and tell a narrative story and plan and do all the normal stuff, right? So, and distinguish between himself and other, even if it clearly got kind of weird at some points.
Mm-hmm. And approaches that... So it sounds like your approach mainly looks at increasing the resolution of your attention to pay very careful attention to what's actually going on.
And the inclusiveness and tuning it to the specific components that make up the sense of a doer, knower, beer, controller, continuous linear time being.
Mm-hmm. And then I could have totally misunderstood these paths, but my understanding of something more in the direction of Mahamudra or Dzogchen would be paying as much attention to awareness itself. And
assuming
noticing how
you can find any awareness that is not just ordinary phenomena. Right. So,
yeah.
The perspective, like to just open attention up as a wide open thing. I mean, it is very much in some ways taking result as method. There's no question, because the open just room doing itself right here in an open, even, clear, straightforward way, right? Which is, you know, some people are gonna be annoyed that I just reduced Dzogchen or some aspects of Mahamudra to that. But, you know, that is the punchline, right? And so taking punchline as joke or something is, I get why they say they're doing that. And I think it's a fair advertisement. And it works well for some people at certain stages of practice, and it really doesn't work well for others. So for some people in certain stages of practice or with certain sort of tendencies or proclivities or backgrounds or sets of causality, when you tell them to do that, it goes super well. And they're able to be, oh yeah, right here, this immediate, transient, ephemeral, natural sort of, you know, awareness all the way through it, or manifestation as awareness or kind of thing. Oh yeah, thank you for pointing that out to me. That was super cool. And other people given that same set of teachings just kind of space out and they're like, oh yeah, I guess this is it, but it isn't really. And they then lack training the mental precision that would actually really make it be the full thing. And, you know, so, but I think for the right people, and I'm not sure I know who exactly those people are. I don't know how to predict that. Dzogchen and Mahamudri sorts of very immediate, you know, zazen, you know, just sitting, just practice enlightenment, dogeni kind of perspectives are super great thing for them to hear and help counterbalance the, oh, I'm going to contract into the breath and see this object and concentrate in a one-pointed fashion, then just miss the whole rest of the party, which is screaming empty immediacy, transience, luminosity, whatever, you know, so...